is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I am Don Soa. This is AM 790, your home of talking business. I'm glad to have you with me here during your drive time home. Well, the market today was, I don't know whether I was going to use the word paralyzed or mesmerized. I don't know, one or another. But they, you know, everybody seemed to be focusing their attention on, well, on Washington, D.C., up on the Hill, and the testimony before the Senate committees with James Comey, former FBI director, giving his testimony today. Markets did close higher, I mean, although not dramatically. The Dow hit an intraday record across during the course of the day, but then basically slipped back to end up, but just about on just under 9 points higher. United Healthcare contributed mostly to that little bit of a reversal that we saw. There were no real bombshells coming out of the Comey testimony. A large number of the key points that everybody was kind of hoping to hear about were redirected towards the closed-door hearings that followed the open-door hearings, which dominated most of today's attention. A number of analysts, including Lindsay Bell, who's over at CFRA, she added that the market really experienced a small relief rally, I guess, that pushed the 30-stock index, the Dow, to a bit of a new high. And I think the concept of a relief rally is you have to understand the market normally would not vote one way or another. It's not voting for existing administration policy or against it, you know, the policy. But it doesn't like surprises. It doesn't like uncertainty. And that's really where the markets lie. They would rather see consistency. They would rather see programs moving forward. They would like to see the House and the Senate, you know, putting together bills that can go to the desk of the president, especially bills that will be about economic growth here in the United States and fiscal policy programs, which have been ignored for a great many years. A large part of what has moved this market since the recession of 07 and 08 have been related to monetary policy. The efforts of the Federal Reserve seem to have a lot more to do with what has driven this market for the last 7 or 8 years, more so than what has happened coming out of the House, the Senate, or out of the Oval Office. Well, now we're in a new year, a new administration, and a new dynamic with the House and Senate in the control of the Republicans and, of course, the White House, with Donald Trump sitting at the big desk in the Oval Office. The theory seems to be emerging, and this is a political statement, and I'm not particularly political, but or I try not to be, or I don't know as much about that as I do about the economy or the market, but I do know that the markets are fraught with individuals who would rather see some level of certainty rather than speculating. But you know, the markets are going to do this every day. Right now, we're moving into the summer months where you'll get a lot of lower volume trading, and that creates a different dynamic. And we may actually be, as we move into the third quarter especially, into an environment where the market kind of moves within a range or kind of sideways ultimately before we get into some of the periods where greater productivity exists, like the fourth quarter. The S&P 500 closed little changed, nearly hitting a record high of its own. Utilities leading decliners, while higher bank stocks capped some of the losses, making sure that we didn't decline too much. Bank stocks, some of the early beneficiaries from the Trump election, rose today. The S&P, or what we call the Spider Bank ETF, the symbol is KBE, it jumped more than 2.5% during the course of the day. Investors in that space also kept an eye on the House, as they prepared to vote on the Financial Choice Act. Jeremy Klein, who's a chief market strategist over at FBN Security, said that they tested 2,440, that number, we tested that on the S&P 500, and we didn't break it. He thinks that some large-cap traders are just taking some profits in this environment, which makes it a little bit more difficult for them to break through to new highs. Now, the NASDAQ advanced about 0.39% today and hit an all-time intraday high. Now, during the course of the day, the testimony of, as I said, former FBI Director James Comey dominated most people's attention. And in his testimony, Comey did say that he kept records of his conversations with the president, or even when he was just the president-elect, something he did not do or feel the need to do when Barack Obama was president, because he thought Trump was a less honest individual and might have been inclined to lie. And he wanted to have exact, or as close to what he could remember coming out of those meetings, exact representations recorded, so that if he was forced sometime in the future or down the road to come back and reiterate the points that were made in those conversations, that he would have as accurate a recording or accurate a memory of those events as he possibly could. So he kept copious notes. He obviously, for what rightly or wrongly, didn't feel the need to do that when Barack Obama was the president. Investors don't seem to be spooked by a lot of this, according to Eric Ains, who's president and founder of Titus Wealth Management. The only thing that could be an issue, of course, is potential delays in tax cuts that the market would like to see happen and would love to see happen during the course of this first year of the current administration. Now, traders listen closely as they assessed how damaging Comey's remarks might be for President Trump and whether he could implement his pro-growth agenda in this kind of an environment. Now, that's really kind of what the market cares about right now, according to Bob Pavlik. He's with Boston Private Wealth. Expectations for tax reform, deregulation, infrastructure spending, all of these things were a key catalyst for stocks after the Trump election occurred. But uncertainty about the implementation of those measures has grown. With time going by, it has grown more and more as the Trump administration is forced to put out one fire after another. And they've been focusing a lot more attention on some of the issues and problems that emerge out of the president's tendency to sort of set the fires with his nightly tweeting. The Senate Intelligence Committee released Comey's written testimony on Wednesday, in which Comey said that he believed the president wanted him to drop an investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and the Flynn's ties to Russia. Now, the release of Comey's opening statement for his Thursday testimony late in the day by Senate Intelligence Committee was a major event and was, of course, interpreted as sort of risk positive by the market, since, according to their read, it did not really appear to offer any kind of a smoking gun against the administration. Bond yields did rise slightly. The benchmark 10-year yield held right in around 2.20%, while the 2-year note yield traded right around 1.33%. Larry McDonald, who's the head of U.S. Macro Strategies at ACG Analytics, said that bonds could really see a sharp downturn, however. There's clearly not enough there, so bonds likely, kind of sell off as part of that environment. Wall Street also digested news coming from Europe, so what's happening in Washington is not the only thing going on around the world. European Central Bank kept interest rates unchanged. The ECB dropped all references to a future rate cut from its statement, but did add that it would be ready to extend its quantitative easing QE program if needed. In other words, they're poised to do so. They're not abandoning the possibility that it may be more stimulative effort. The euro fell about 0.4% to $1.12 against the dollar. Now, also in Europe, you had voters who in the United Kingdom made their way to the polls for what is their general election right now. Prime Minister Theresa May called for the election in April. That's 7 weeks ago. Her Conservative Party had a seemingly unassailable lead over the left-wing Labour Party, but that lead has narrowed since that particular time, although it's still believed to have a meaningful enough lead to retain control of Britain's parliament, which would, of course, keep Theresa May in her position as prime minister. Well, again, we did this before. Everybody thought they called it right on the Brexit vote, and everybody said Great Britain would not vote to leave the European Union. So I guess a great many of the pollsters are a little bit nervous about really honestly trying to predict what's going to happen in this vote. But the polls did close before I got here to do tonight's radio show, so we'll have to wait over the course of the next several hours as they tally all the numbers. Then we'll have a better sense maybe before before you go to bed tonight, you might have a better sense of what happened in Europe and if it's meaningful, as well as some projections and prognosticating about whether it affects us at all. We'll have to just wait and see. Hey, folks, I'm Don Sowa. Thanks for tuning in tonight. This is AM 790, your talk home of talking business. Our number to call, 437-5000. 888-345-0790. I know you're going to be excited, but guess who's here? Yeah, Brett, our producer. He's here tonight. Yeah, he came back. And at least for tonight, he'll be taking your calls. So if you have any questions, just give him a buzz. I'm Don Sowa. I'll be right back. We're back with the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Sowa. Delighted to have you joining us during your drive time home. Drive safely. But we're here to chat with you about what's happening in the world around us. Some of it sometimes affected by politics, some of it by economics. And, of course, it's not just politics here in the U.S. It's politics all over the world. But we also get topics that pop up because of, what we call analytics. I mean, people study the history of markets. They study the history of people who are successful investors, people who've employed certain styles of investing that seemingly over long periods of time have been successful. And I'm going to imagine one of the most famous investors out there, and one that has been given a lot of credit for his long-term view of the world, is Warren Buffett. Warren is the chairman of Berkshire Hathaway. That's the name of his parent company. And he has employed a style of investing for many years called value investing. Now, what's happening here... So, I mean, I've had people say, well, why don't I just try to duplicate what Warren Buffett does? And by the way, there are investment strategists who do that because people who invest like Buffett over time do, in fact, have to usually file their investment strategies with the SEC, especially when they're making a meaningful investment percentage purchase. Those things are usually publicly disclosed, not at the time of the trade initially or beforehand, but usually in a short time afterwards, you have a pretty good sense of what Warren Buffett is buying, or at least the general thought. And Buffett has had this habit of publicly disclosing, because he's a regular in the financial news like CNBC and elsewhere. He actually gets out there and says what he's doing. He says what he's thinking, and he has a couple of money managers working for him also, realizing that the amount of money that they're running is billions and billions of dollars, and it's a little bit much for any one person. But Wall Street is starting to question the value investing strategy that has been espoused by legendary investors such as Buffett. You know, after about a decade of weak returns, the last decade hasn't been ideal or a perfect testament to the value style of investing. Now, the value strategy's poor performance has coincided with a swell of assets that have moved into passive equity investment strategies like the index funds, as well as some quantitative or smart beta type funds. According to Goldman strategist Ben Snyder, who was writing a report this past week entitled The Death of Value. Now, other styles of investing are, of course, growth, right? Well, the disconnect has led investors to question the future viability of this historic style of investing known as value investing. Of course, it is a style which has been embraced not only by Wall Street in some areas, but by academic literature, and has been espoused by investors, including some historic investors of the past, some of whom set the foundation for what is current trading practices on Wall Street, gentlemen like Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett himself. Snyder, who noted that the value investing's long-short strategy, based on Eugene Fama and Kenneth French's work, it generated an average annual return of about 5% from 1940 through 2007. Now, what does the strategy do? Well, the simple strategy, of course, was buy stocks that have the lowest valuations, low price-to-earnings ratios, PEs, and sell those that have the highest. That realized a theoretical gain in 7 out of every 10 years and never actually spent 3 full years below its previous high watermark. So it was a reasonably successful strategy, not knocking the ball out of the park, but that's not what investors in that strategy were looking for. Now, what has happened is, which has caused gentlemen, analysts, and people like Snyder to question the future appropriateness of value-style investing, is that performance in recent years has failed, has faltered. The strategist said investors that use the same long-short value strategy They generated a 15% cumulative loss in the past decade in negative returns in six out of the last 10 years. Snyder explained why the returns have suffered. He said that the value style has historically posted its strongest returns during periods of strong economic growth early in the economic cycle. The factor typically wanes late in the cycle as investors search for what we call secular growth, those opportunities occurring when economic growth is slowing. Concerns about the possibility of secular stagnation in recent years have compounded the investor hunt for growth, which is why growth has been more dominant and in higher demand than value-style investing. Now, Goldman Sachs chief U.S. equity strategist David Kostin also told analysts and some people recently this week on CNBC why growth stocks outperform in sluggish economic environments. A modest growth environment means that growth is still relatively scarce, so the growth stocks, where tech is a prominent area, obviously, the NASDAQ would be a part of that, growth stocks are likely to continue to do relatively well and to outperform during periods of modest growth. And we have here in the U.S. clearly not been in a highly robust period for economic growth, growing at an average rate of 2% or less over the last several years, since the recession at least in 07 and 08. But perhaps investors should actually heed history. The last time Wall Street questioned Buffett's favorite strategy, it preceded a relatively strong multi-year run for value investing. That would have meant a period of time where the growth style was dominating. And if it dominated for a period of time, you know, at some point somebody's going to say, well, I guess that marks the death of Warren Buffett's style of investing. He's just an old guy. I used to hear that kind of a tune. Yeah, he's just an old timer and he's outdated. Well, what happened? Well, during the height of the dot-com bubble back in 1999, when technology growth investing was really crushing the market overall, people used to joke that, you know, you could open the Wall Street Journal's stock page and put it up on the wall, step back and throw darts at it, and whatever stocks you hit, just buy them. They're all going to make money. Well, I guess when investors in general think that investing successfully is too easy and that anybody can do it, well, that's when you probably know you're pretty damn close to the end of a stock market booming cycle. Well, anyway, at that period of time, back in the bubble of 99, Buffett defended value investing in a classic column for Fortune magazine. He said that at Berkshire Hathaway, we focus almost exclusively on the valuations of individual companies, looking only to a very limited extent at the valuation of the overall market. Even then, valuing the market has nothing to do with where it's going to go next week or next month or next year. A line of thought we never get into. The fact is that markets behave in ways, sometimes for a very long stretch, that are not always linked to value. Sooner or later, though, value counts, according to Buffett, and those are words he offered November of 1999. And to be sure, Warren Buffett's value style differs from Goldman's simplistic study of the long-short approach to value. The Oracle of Omaha, which is, of course, the name that they call Warren Buffett, he says that he looks for really good companies with strong management, companies with competitive advantages at a good price. And he never explicitly stated that you need to sell a stock once the valuation got high. That's what Snyder's approach was, that you buy stocks with low valuations, hopefully following Buffett's model, where you're saying, yes, I'm looking for strong managements as companies that clearly have a competitive advantage. I like the idea of a company that actually offers a product or a service that its consumers consider to be important. It's probably going to do well if it's considered important yet still trading at a reasonable price. So in this case here, Buffett was never saying that, unlike in the long short model, that once the stock gets to a certain price, higher valuation, that you have to sell it. If the dynamics of management and competitive advantage still exist, then there may be upside potential for the stock price, and so you continue to hold it. But in the end, Goldman Snyder is not giving up on value investing, though, although he's criticizing it or trying to analyze the periods of time when it does well or not. He believes that value will remain a good long-term strategy, although future returns will likely be a bit lower than what were the historical averages. Behavioral finance suggests that some value premium will persist even as changes in the investment landscape reduce its expected returns going forward. That's according to Mr. Snyder from Goldman Sachs. Hey, folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa, delighted to have you here with me, talking about investing strategies from the past, and are they outdated? Well, the people at Goldman Sachs and a few others who are evaluating things are not quite sure. They criticize, they evaluate, but in the end, I think in the end, ignoring Warren Buffett is not a good idea if you want to make some money. I'm Don Sowa. We'll be back with more Money Talk right here on AM 790.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we welcome you to the second half of tonight's Money Talk program. I am Don Sowa, delighted to have you here with me. On Tuesday, if you tuned into the program, you were listening to myself and my daughter, Donna Sowa Allard, certified financial planner professional. And we like to talk about basic concepts and things that people need to know if they want to take advantage of investing or savings opportunities or planning opportunities that that will become available to them if they haven't already become available. One of the, I guess, commonsensible things that we talk about when they're saying, well, what are the things you need to do to be successful? And among the things that I guess you would say, well, geez, Don, that's just common sense. And that is, of course, to start as early as possible, indicating that if you were putting away $300 a month starting at age 25 and getting perhaps a 7 to 8% return on your money over time, and you were consistent doing this, that by the time you reached a full retirement age at around 67, you would have well over $1.3 million put away. They tried to also show if you waited until you were considerably older with considerably less time, even putting the $300 away is not going to be enough. I mean, it makes perfectly good sense, and I get that. But there are people who would arguably say, and I was talking to a gentleman about this just this afternoon, and he said, well, you know, what if when you were younger, started out of that first job and you get married and all of a sudden you have the kids and then you're worried about trying to handle the cost of the roof over your heads and supporting a car and all the things that, you know, that come on, some of which come in expectedly because you planned and some of them that come on as a surprise. Well, suddenly you find that paycheck gets stretched and doesn't go very far. And the ability to put away that $300 a month that I mentioned and invest it properly, invest it prudently, becomes limited. Well, yes, it's wise to start saving for retirement as soon as you get your first job. I get it. And, of course, the one thing you like about it is get a plan that has the money coming out of your paycheck. Out of sight, out of mind is the phrase that goes with that. And start putting away 10% of your pay or more, if you can. Then that savings becomes a fixed expense for you. It's part of your cash flow demand. And you will build your lifestyle around the other money that you do, in fact, have available. Again, it's about discipline. It's about habits. Developing great savings and investment habits early on makes sense. But we're not going to try to discourage those folks who didn't start when they were in their early 20s. You know, for those who delayed or were unable to really start, you know, hope is not lost. I mean, it's more difficult, but it's not lost. If you're starting even at age 50, it's possible to save more than $1 million for retirement, according to research released in May by an organization called the American Association of Individual Investors. That's AAII. Or looking at it perhaps another way, even for those who have very little in the way of savings by the time they reach their 50th birthday, adding $1 million to that nest egg from that point is attainable. It can be done. I mean, I'm not suggesting it's necessarily easy. I'm just letting you know that all hope is not lost. Many 401k participants perhaps save less than the 15% of pay that is often recommended, according to data from Vanguard and Fidelity. Now, there are a number of different analysts and a number of different studies provided by the AAII program and their analysis, and they show five different scenarios of how much people actually can accumulate by saving from age 50 to age 70. So we've extended, part of what we did here as part of this exercise was we've extended a full retirement age from 65 or 66 and took it out to age 70. let's face it, we're living longer. We are basically, you get to 65 and you are younger than perhaps your parents' or grandparents' generation would have been at the same age. Many people who get to 65 or 66 feel comfortable. They want to still continue working, and they're vital, they're bright, and they are highly experienced. Now, among the things that you can do if suddenly you get to age 50 and you decide that, oh my gosh, the major goal for me is going to be retirement, let's look at some of the choices. So of the five scenarios the AAII looked at, let's look at them. You make maximum 401k contributions, including what we call the catch-up provision for those who are over 50 years old. Now that you're over 50, you have the right to use the catch-up provision. And that will allow you to put away from payroll as much as $24,000 a year. And you can get a deduction and have that reducing your taxable income by that amount. Not bad. You make the full $18,000. Another scenario is you make the full $18,000 a year 401k contribution, but you are unable or you choose to skip the catch-up provision, the extra $6,000. Okay. Hey, look, I'm still pleased if you're doing the $18,000. You save $1,000 a month, another scenario, which allows you, and you could do this anywhere. You could do this in a plan, an organized plan, or you could do it in an individual or joint account that is not part of a specifically tax-sheltered retirement plan. But you put that money in $1,000 a month and you dollar-cost average, and you set aside about $12,000 a year as a result of that effort. Now, another strategy, another scenario would be you contribute the maximum each year to your IRA, including a catch-up contribution if you're over 50, which means you're putting away about $6,500 per year or just over about $500 a month. Now, the other scenario is, of course, you make the maximum $5,500 IRA contribution that you can have no matter what your age is, but you skip the additional $1,000 catch-up provision. Now, in each case, Charles Rotblut, who is the vice president of AAII and editor of the AAII Journal, he assumes that you would earn, rightly or wrongly, maybe he's being a little ambitious here, but he assumes that you're going to earn about 8% a year from your stock and bond portfolio. It's probably, honestly, between you and me, if you're successfully doing that, you're probably in a heavily stock-weighted or equity-weighted portfolio. The 401k and IRA contribution limits are based on the rules for the year 2017. Now, the projected account balance at age 70 ranges from about $1.3 million for a person who maxes out his or her 401k, including the catch-up. Now, that means your catch-up contributions, you're putting in about $300,000 for a person who saves, the other range. Remember I said $1.3 million for the one who's putting in ultimately $24,000 a year, starting at 50, at 8%. Now, the other range would be for the person who is able to save only the $5,500 basic annual IRA limit, which is the amount any person can put into an IRA if you have that much earned income. If you're getting 8% return, that could grow to age 70 to about $300,000. So it's about 20% or almost basically cleared it, almost 20% of what you can do if you're maxing out your 401k plan. Now, of course, for people who have been sort of half-hearted savers, it's not part of your personality. It's not part of that discipline that you really need to do this successfully, I think. Putting aside as much as $24,000 a year starting at age 50, even if you have a pretty substantial paycheck, it may not be easy. It may be a hard discipline to embrace. Now, meeting that goal will likely involve changing your savings and your spending habits, cutting some habitual or even mindless day-to-day spending that you do. You may want to ask yourself how many times you stop at your favorite coffee place at the drive-thru and buy a iced coffee and a muffin or whatever it is you do. You may want to cut that in half. Who knows? Now, if you're one of those folks that tends to go to Starbucks, you may be paying twice that for a cup of coffee. But that's a start if you can back away from all that daytime, morning, afternoon, and evening drinking. But for people who don't have a history of savings, it may also require far bigger changes like downsizing your housing costs or perhaps even taking a second job, bringing in more revenue, allowing you to save that extra money. Some diligent savers take similar moves in order to afford early retirement. So we've seen a lot of different strategies related to this. So retiring with $1 million extra dollars at age 70 or even retiring earlier with a slightly lesser but appropriate amount of income or amount of money it does require some levels of discipline. Now, people need to look for ways to both save and consider what they can do to boost their income, whether it's getting a promotion where you're at, which gives you more money to put away. Changing jobs may be your only choice. There may be no upside growth or income opportunities in your current job. Or, in some aspects, considering having a part-time job in addition to the existing full-time job that you have, and making a commitment to save as much or even all of the revenue that you generate from your part-time job. Now, a recent study found that more Americans than ever believe that they will need at least $1 million for a comfortable retirement. But dwelling on that target number will probably make the task a lot more daunting, maybe even a little depressing. Worrying about the big number they're going to reach, it's going to seem almost unattainable. Instead of doing that, some people should focus on finding ways to save money, because they'll realize they'll make far more progress than what they think will be possible, you know, going forward. I mean, again, it's there is a real psychology to this, but start as soon as you can. I mean, if this discussion does anything, it illustrates for you the value of starting, instead of waiting to age 50, starting at age 40 or starting at age 30. Tuesday's discussion with Donna Allard on the Get Back to Basics program can show you that starting in your 20s with that very first job and earmarking just part of that money early on means you can put less money away, you can earmark more money for your growing lifestyle obligations and choices, and ultimately still have the opportunity to get to a normal retirement and at least have some choices in mind. Now, again, the strategies you employ once you get to retirement, whether it's a question of where you live, how you live, what kind of discretionary spending you require, of course, the way you deal with your obligations, the way you deal with your debt, a whole series of factors that are all part of your retirement-based financial planning, well, those are all things that you can consider, and we will continue to talk about them here on the Money Talk program in the years ahead. Hey, folks, there's a lot of people here in Southern New England who listen to this show who are now in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. If you're in your less years that are younger than that, maybe take advantage of those who have failed and make sure that you're one of the people that succeed with your goals. I'm Don Sowell. We're going to take a quick break here on Money Talk, and I'll be right back. And we're back with tonight's last segment. Now, you know what I did? I decided to spend a few minutes here, instead of talking so much about saving money and putting money away and redirecting money from your lifestyle into your 401k or your IRAs or your savings, and say, okay, well, that's all very well and good. What happens when you get to 66 or 70 years old? What about spending your retirement savings? You spent all the time talking about growing it, creating it, but what happens when you get there? When you start to replace a paycheck, which is what happens when you retire, what you've done, hopefully, if you planned like we've discussed over these last many years here on Money Talk, you know, the idea of using company-sponsored plans or independent savings that you do on your own, you know, what you're ultimately doing is you're building a money machine. You've got a money machine now called your job, right? You provide a service to the company, they pay you a paycheck. You pay your bills with that. You create your lifestyle. You support your obligations with that paycheck. But at some point in time, the money machine called your job goes away, hopefully by your choice, I'd hope, not dictated to you by your circumstances or by somebody else. But in the end, you have to start thinking about independent retirement, getting out from underneath the job schedule, in looking to sources that will support you and support the lifestyle you feel you've enjoyed. So what you're doing is you're replacing that paycheck, and hopefully you've built your own money machine. Now, you got to consider the different resources that you have and to start to develop a plan. It's a good idea to do that well before you get to retirement, though. Usually there will be some sources of what we call dependable income, Social Security, maybe if you're really lucky, a pension of some sort. The rest of the cash flow you need to fund your lifestyle will have to come from your savings. Now, hopefully you've you know, have some after-tax savings, maybe some cash you received. Maybe you inherited something if you're really lucky. I don't know. I don't think too many people want to depend on inheriting money. But you may have sold your big, big, big house that got to be too big. When now all the kids are all gone. They've grown up. They're off on their own. Now you downsize a little bit, and you take the net proceeds of the sale of that property, the long-time house, and you move into something more manageable, something with less cost, something that allows you to capture some income. That's not bad. You may also have an IRA or a 401k or a 403b plan from your working years. Maybe even have a Roth, which would be really cool because it's tax sheltered, but you could take money out of it without paying taxes. It's tax-free coming out. That's really cool. The government doesn't tell you that you have to take the money out. Now, which retirement accounts should you withdraw from first? That may be the big question. The question then becomes, what's the best way to take that money out? Which accounts matter? Which accounts are the most cost-effective? The answer, like most answers in the financial planning world, is it depends on a lot of things that you've done, a lot of your planning. In different scenarios, we've seen a fictitious retired couple we're talking about has three buckets of money to choose from. They have their after-tax money, which you might just call like a savings account that may be in the bank or a money market, and that may have come from the sale of their house. Maybe they're living in a really nice condo now. Maybe they own it because they downsized, or they're leasing it. This money that's after-tax money has already been taxed at some point, so you don't have to worry about that. And any cash flow that comes from this bucket of money is not going to be taxable again, except maybe if unless you've had some interest that has grown on it. Roth IRA accounts, as I mentioned, funded in the years leading up to retirement, this gives them a bucket of tax-free money. That's really cool. Now, by managing which bucket you take money out of to fund your cash flow needs, you can, to some degree, control the tax consequences of your retirement income. For example, you might want to take distributions from your post-tax bucket first. Any cash taken from this account is not taxable, except for perhaps the tax that you have due on some interest or some dividends that you might have. But that's generally okay because capital gains, if that's the way it's taxed, are taxed at a lower rate than ordinary income. And depending upon your tax bracket, they may even be tax-free. Now, if you are taking distributions from your retirement account, those funds are considered ordinary income, of course, and they're going to be taxed at your ordinary income rate, which is the highest rate you typically pay. So monitor how much you're taking there, and if you're getting close to moving into a higher tax bracket because of the amount you're drawing there and still need cash flow, you can take some distributions from the tax-free pile, maybe even the Roth account if necessary. If you're working with a CPA or a tax professional, they can help you with this. They can help you to determine, well, which are the most cost-efficient, tax-efficient places to take my money from. Now, remember, the example that I'm giving you is just that, an example. It's not a recommendation for everyone because not everybody's in the same situation. We do, however, recommend that everyone review your individual situation by doing some actual, not only savings and investment planning, but some tax planning. Having a distribution plan in place can help you get the cash flow you need while lessening the tax bite on those treasured retirement dollars that you have. So yes, there's not always a perfect answer to everything, but the way in which you choose to take money may in fact matter. You may decide as you're looking at your income that, well, you know, not all of Social Security is typically added to my adjusted gross income, so there's some efficiency there. And then some money coming out of my cash savings and out of my Roth will be taxed at the most favorable situation. So maybe you take some money there before you start drawing all of the money out of your 401k or IRA money. Talk to your financial advisor. They'll help you with this. They'll make sure you're doing it right. As my mother used to say, it's not what you make that matters. It's what you keep that counts. And I think she was talking about taxes. Hey, I'm Don Sowa. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Steve Beauvais will be here with more Money Talk. I hope you're here too.